This is an ABC podcast.
Political commentator George Megalogenis is back on Conversations today. And George is here to talk about football and his beloved team, the Richmond Tigers, who won the 2017 Grand Final after a long premiership drought. Now, let me just say that this isn't going to be a conversation really about sport. Not really. It's really a conversation about our national life in Australia. George Megalogenis is using the story of Richmond Football Club to remind us, and those who are in the political system, that there are better ways to run the country than the way we're doing it now. Because even though Richmond is just one footy club among many, it's much more diverse than our parliament. Its players and management and supporters look like contemporary Australia. It now plans for the long term. It no longer ditches its leaders in a panic. And it has 100,000 members, more than all the political parties. George says that Richmond pulled itself out of a hole by finding a new way to win, a new way that was more joyous and more inclusive. And he thinks Australia could do the same. George's book is called The Football Solution, How Richmond's Premiership Can Save Australia. Hello, George.
I have not met a human being that didn't laugh at the subtitle. So I take it that you realise the tongue is in the cheek on that subtitle.
Well, I certainly hope so. I'm deeply offended in ending the conversation now, quite frankly.
You want to end it now?
How Richmond's Premiership Can Save Australia. I reckon the Swans did all this in 2005, but that's a whole other book, I reckon.
They may have well and truly been first, when they were first in 2005... The political system wasn't sacking a leader, Richmond, old Richmond style, every year. So maybe we need to update the story every 10 or so years.
Maybe so. Tell me, first of all, how did you become attached to the Richmond Football Club?
I tell people I was born into Richmond, which means that I didn't grow up in Richmond. My mother landed in Richmond as a young Greek migrant in 1962. The government paid her airfare to come out to Australia in the early 60s. She lands in Richmond and she very quickly intuits the cultural code of her new country. Meets my father in Carlton, where else are two Greeks going to meet, but another inner city suburb of Melbourne. Implausible for them to have met in Greece because he's an islander and she's from the north of Greece. Quickly, they get married, have a child, me, have another one, my sister. She sent me to school in 1969 to kinder with my name tag, George Megalogenis, and a footy team. So essentially, my identity going into school was as a football supporter for this club, Richmond, which was a suburb she would have lived in for about 6 months, which is a suburb I never set foot in as a young kid until I went to my first game of footy.
So, wow. So you had Richmond tattooed on your soul by your mother much at kinder.
I think I wouldn't have been the first one. I think this is a fairly typical experience in Victoria. And certainly by the 70s, you've got about two or three generations, even before the post-war migration wave, you've got about two, three or four generations of Australians passing on from grandfather to father to son to great-grandson and order a tribal identity. Now, these tribal identities, by the time I've turned up as a supporter in the late 60s, early 70s, these tribal identities have completely broken the containment line of the suburb itself. These are tribal identities fixed on a particular postcode, but you could be living anywhere at that point in footy's journey.
How do you remember the first match you attended?
I do remember a fair bit of 1971. So my first vivid memories as a child, my first vivid cultural memories of the moon landing at school, which we watched on TV, and I kept these Apollo mission scrapbooks. And the second cultural memory is I remember my dad telling me, who was a Fitzroy supporter, because logically my dad's first day on Australian soil was at an arts place in Fitzroy, so he had to be a Fitzroy supporter. My first memory is of footballers of Dad telling us that Richmond won the 1969 Premiership. Very quickly in 1970, the first round of the new season is the first game they played on a Sunday, and the royal family come to visit. And they interrupted the game at halftime. All the players had to sort of spruce up after the first half of the game, and out comes the Queen and the royal family to greet all these players in the middle of a game. And Dad, bless him, was teasing me all that afternoon. Fitzroy had beaten Richmond in the opening game of 1970. So they're my very, very early footy memories. 71, I was well and truly into it. We're watching the replays. I had a Hawthorn supporting teacher at school. I had a Hawthorn supporting art, and Hawthorn were the top team in the competition. And all year I nagged my parents to send me to a game. Dad's a signal worker, a signalman, railway signalman, and a shift worker at the Victorian Railway. So there was no way he could take me on a Saturday. So Mum took us one Saturday late in July of 1971. And the largest crowd I think I would have seen up to that point would have been a couple of hundred guests at my Aunt Helen's wedding. And there were close to 50,000 people at the MCG that day. And I'm 7 years old and I've never seen anything or heard anything like it. And it's a noise that stayed with me for the rest of my life. It was the most life-affirming noise when a Richmond goal was scored. And it was the most tragic thing. I felt like the minority of the crowd, which would have been the Hawthorn supporters, when they kicked one of their goals, I felt like they'd personally singling me out in the stand, picking on me, saying, "Your team is a goal down now, and we're going to get you."
That's it. So you really took it personally, in other words.
I had no frame of reference, and I wonder how most people's first contact with sport on that scale. And this is something that's been going on for about 80 or 90 years by the time I've turned up. And I've got no idea of the backstory, and I've got no idea of the sort of communal habits that attach themselves to this event. When I turned up, I think it was the most fantastic thing I'd ever seen in my life up until that point. And it doesn't leave you very quickly. It's like your first rock concert as well. It doesn't actually leave you. And not that you're forever trying to recreate the experience every time you go. It's a very, very warm, comforting place, a sporting arena. When you're there with 10, 20, 30, 40, 50,000 people who identify as you do for the same team, and they can come from any part of Australia, and, you know, for those couple of hours, you're sitting there watching your team together, cheering them on, sharing the stories with your friends and your family that you're watching it with, I actually can't think of a better space in Australian public life.
Yeah, I'd lost interest in footy in my teenage years and came back to it in my 30s. And I've discovered one of the pleasures of watching a game live is that it's both very exciting and very relaxing at the same time.
Yes.
And you have excellent conversations that don't really have any kind of, because you're sitting side by side, and exactly. So you have better conversations that way.
It's like a long train journey.
Yes.
It's what I imagine in the past train journeys between families would have been like if the families weren't trying to settle scores. I'm a bit like you. Yeah. Once you sort of hit your teens, you get to uni, you get into the workforce, the last thing you want to do is to sort of set aside, you know, sort of mental and mental energy and then physical time in your diary. We're sort of trying to work out which band to see that weekend, not what game to go to. And I pretty much like you left it for a good decade or so. But on return, and the thing that brought me back in the 30s was my mum. She still wanted to go, so it was actually great family catch-up time.
So why do you think your mum attached herself so passionately to the game as a young migrant to Australia?
She can't, she can't answer this question because it's the sort of her Greekness arriving in Australia, and then she became a Richmond supporter and she never let it go. So this is almost, it's almost like her foundation story in Melbourne, coming to the suburb, finding a job, meeting this guy, at finding this football team, starting a family. They're all wrapped up in the same, to her, it's the same blur of events. And I think because I've spent a bit of time trying to understand the past, how the past brought me to the position that I found myself in, and a lot of people of my age found ourselves in, the identity in that suburb, certainly by the 60s and 70s, still so tightly connected to the club. The suburb itself, and this is, the suburb's more interesting, I think, than the club in many ways. Because like a lot of the inner city suburbs, certainly in Sydney and Brisbane, and certainly those old industrial suburbs in Adelaide, the attachment to the local team was the thing that made these people feel really good about themselves. Now, Richmond in the 60s is still a slum. Now, to tell a contemporary Australian audience that there were slums all the way up until the 70s, you know, even to when we turned on colour TV, we still had slums in Australia.
Particularly in suburbs that now have multi-million dollar houses in them, in Melbourne, like Richmond, Carlton, Fitzroy.
Pretty much the entire housing and former industrial stock of the inner city has been converted to a form of living which would have been unthinkable to people of my mum's generation.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So through the 60s, when Richmond is a slum, by that stage, for about 30 or 40 years, people are leaving that suburb. More people are leaving that suburb than arriving in that suburb. And if the Greeks hadn't turned up in the 60s and 70s, it would have been a ghost suburb. There would have been no one left. I did plot the graph stupidly. Not stupidly. I'm a bit of a data nerd, as you know. So I had a good look at the population story of a suburb like Richmond. I think it's quite emblematic. Big surge in the 1880s when Dame Nellie Melba is the most famous daughter of Australia the daughter of that suburb, is making her international debut in the 1880s. Land boom turns to bust, and then people start leaving for the leafier, so-called leafier, or the garden suburbs.
Kew, Hawthorne, Malvern, all those suburbs.
Essendon, yeah. They're just leaving. And what's left behind is an underclass, sort of light, pretty stinky industrial suburb, very high unemployment, poverty, very sectarian, divided place. The rest of the city is looking down on this place. In fact, locationally, Richmond is almost the most rich man, poor man suburb divided by the Yarra. On one side of the Yarra is Toorak. Looking down from Toorak, you see the old industrial areas of Richmond. And in fact, if you pass through today, you can imagine if you put your mind back to that era, that the class divide is that dirty brown
river.
Mm.
When I was shown the geography of Melbourne once, I was shown that north of the Yarra there's Church Street, yes. And south of it is Chapel Street.
Yes.
At Church Street is rough as guts as it was in the 80s, still, yeah. Richmond. Chapel Street, though, then you're getting into Brand, south.
Yeah, as soon as you cross that bridge, so when Church becomes Chapel, as soon as you cross that bridge over the Yarra, you would have added in those days 50% to your average income. And the equivalent to your property prices.
So in the post-war years, a whole lot of Greek migrants, like your parents, came into Richmond, or people like them came into Richmond. Then in the 80s, there was a big Vietnamese migration into Richmond as well.
Absolutely. So Richmond, and in fact, Collingwood is even more Greek than Richmond, which I discovered, much to my shock, because I probably ended up barracking for the wrong team. I probably should have barracked for Collingwood if I was looking for the most Greek suburb.
Well, we wouldn't be even having this conversation then, George.
No, so. I'd be, in fact, yes, I wouldn't even be me. 20% of the population of Richmond in 1971 was born in Greece. And when you add the kids, you get to a third of that entire suburb is a single ethnic group. By the early 80s, 10% of the population of Vietnamese born. So you get a very, very rapid transfer. See, what was happening all the way through this period, a lot of the local born were leaving for the leafier suburbs. The Greeks get a foothold in a suburb like Richmond, and as soon as they get married and start families, they followed everyone else out. So they go to Doncaster or to Box Hill or to Templestowe or to Oakley. And so they left as well. And so there was always, the only thing that stopped these suburbs from collapsing in those days was the next arrival. And the next arrival sort of put a floor under the population story of those suburbs. The big switch, of course, comes at the turn of the 21st century, where all the professionals are coming back from the outer suburbs and they want to live close to the city, pretty much undoing 100 years of sort of inner city history in the blink of a decade. The club, strangely, was successful through all the bad times. So the darkest decades in sort of Richmond's public life, the 20s, the 30s, premiership years for the club. Again, more dark years in the 60s and especially 70s as the economy goes into stagflation. Another round of premierships.
Right.
Somebody turns on the lights in the 80s and 90s and it starts to gentrify and the club goes down the plug hole and becomes the most mocked sporting team in Australia.
Mm.
Perpetual ninth place finishes. We had the theme song, which of course everybody recognises. It probably should be the national anthem. We're from Tigerland.
Not sure.
Some wag got on a few years ago. In fact, I had friends that when I was still at the Oz, every day I'd come to work and they'd click this song on. It wasn't, oh, we're from Tigerland. It was, we finished ninth. The Richmond Tigers finished ninth again. In any season, you will see it is our fate to miss out on the eight. We win a few and lose a lot, and then it is too late.
You really remembered that.
I played it again as research. But literally the most mocked sporting team in Australia for a good 30-odd years.
And the fact that they've won this year suggests we're headed for an economic downturn. Now, famously, Australian rules football, George, finds its origin, so the story goes, in a man named Tom Wills, who was a Victorian who went to rugby school and learnt to play rugby there, the earliest form of the game when there was sometimes like 100 players on the ground and the game would take all day. But the other formative thing that's said to be, the other formative influence on the sport is said to be the Aboriginal game of Marngrook. And we know that Tom Wills used to play with Aboriginal kids when he was growing up on Port Phillip Bay. What do you make of this story and the willingness to accept the game of Marngrooks and its influence on Australian rules football?
As almost the founding father of the game, Tom Wills is probably the first great sporting figure in Australian history. I mean, he culturally is much more significant than just the sportsman. But one of the things he learnt when he went to rugby school was to play sport year round. So cricket in summer, and a ball game of a kind in winter. And he was the grandson of a convict and the son of a squatter and a politician. He leaves for rugby school before the gold rush, and he returns when Melbourne is marvellous. So in the intervening years that he's away, this colony has erupted onto the global scene. So Melbourne is the most visited port in 1852. He's learning to play rugby and playing cricket at the same time that, you know, all the world's mobile middle-class fortune seekers and working-class fortune seekers are eyeing off this port, and they're choosing Melbourne over a place like California.
Mm.
And he comes back to a place, he leaves it as a sewerless town, and he returns back to this thriving metropolis. And it's sort of his personal epiphany, but it jibed with the times. They win a cricket match, Victoria beats New South Wales in the colonial cricket game. And then he thinks, what are we going to do for winter, lads? Let's play. Let's keep playing. That idea itself was the sort of beginnings of his football epiphany.
Yeah, keeping fit for the cricket season.
For the cricket season in the summer.
Yeah.
So he sits down with his mates, and there's four of them who set up the rules. 1858 is sort of his famous letter to a sporting journal saying, why don't we play, or why don't we take up rifle shooting, something. Let's do something in winter to keep our limbs supple, lads. When they draw the first rules together in 1859, he tells them, because remember, he's coming home a hero, he's a sporting hero, and he's telling his mates, local-born and recently arrived migrants, the paddocks here are way too hard. They're not the sodden playing fields where we used to bass each other up playing rugby. The playing fields are a lot harder. We're going to have to, because there's no other code for them to borrow, there's no other game. So rugby isn't codified. British football, soccer, is not codified. This is 1859, so it's a couple of years ahead of the codification of any of these ball sports, which become sort of mass entertainment spectacles. And so they literally invent a game of their own for the conditions that apply at the time. A lot of these guys who were playing on the Saturday had good jobs during the week. And there was a line in there, one of the very earliest accounts, and I've dug out this line from one of these papers, that these guys didn't want to do the things that were done in rugby. They didn't want hacking. They didn't want their shins kicked. They didn't want to be belted because a black eye and a broken collarbone didn't look good on Collins Street on a Monday.
Right, so you wanted a sport you could play where you could actually go back to work relatively uninjured then?
Uninjured, yes. Right. So the sort of bruises and the broken bones that were trophies of their pluck in their childhood in England in the sort of 1840s and early 1850s made no sense in the social setting in the late 1850s, and we know the data tells us that Melburnians were the world's richest people in the world's richest settlement at the time. That's sort of like the immediate environmental impulse for the game. And so the rules are already going to be different to what rugby is. But the other part, and this is the part you alluded to earlier, before he goes to rugby school, he's a kid growing up in the Western Districts of Victoria. He's the only white kid. He's learnt the language. He's participated in all the ceremonies, and he's played this game with these kids. And we know from early settler accounts in Victoria, we know what sort of game they played because there's some quite vivid descriptions. Now, the descriptions of these games actually fit the game that became Australian rules football. And a couple of the big differences compared to, say, rugby or soccer, there's no offside rule.
Right, so you can have the forward pass.
You can do whatever you want. Yeah. So it's open play. Open play, and I would argue open play actually fits the temperament of those times. So this is a major experimentation, almost the world's first experimentation of mass middle class society. They get the vote, they get the 8-hour day, they've invented the secret ballot. They're doing all these things at the same time that they've invented this game. But the other thing that Margaret's got is some of the action is in the sky, is
above your head. It's flight,
which is the ball being kicked into the air and blokes leaping up to catch it overhead. The high mark doesn't exist in any other code in the world. Even when you look at Gaelic football, they're not marking it over their head. They're not being given an invitation to fly, which is in the literal accounts of Mangrook in the 1840s, as some of the early settlers have written down, that the blokes have kicked the ball as far as they can into the air, and they're all jumping up to try and catch it. And in fact, the spectacle of catching it is half the fun of the game, which is the thing that differentiates Aussie rules from pretty much every other code.
From soccer, from rugby, from gridiron
in the United
States.
Even gridiron in the United States. And so this is the game that clearly has a traditional connection. Because for the life of me, I can't see how you would argue that Wills played this game and then completely forgot about it. And then he came back and he taught them to play this other game because they didn't want to break their legs on a Saturday.
So the interesting thing about Australian rules football, as soon as it's codified, it takes off so quickly in the city of Melbourne and in the surrounding areas like Geelong. It takes off so quickly and starts to attract the biggest crowds in the world, it seems. The biggest, like the kind of crowds that, I think you've written this before, in Europe would mean that the government's going to be overthrown. But in Australia, you get these gigantic crowds forming peaceably to cheer their teams. Now, how important is it to Australia that these teams seem to cut across all other allegiances within the society of the time?
Yeah, so when you look at football's foundation story, and some historians are going to argue sort of black letter, white letter law about what proportion you ascribe to Mongrook. Others may want to ascribe some to Gaelic football. The one thing that to me, and this is where I try to take a fresh look at this with a fresh eye, is have a look at the community itself. And the community certently around the time of the game's invention, then its rapid take-up in the 1860s and the 1870s. Now, remember, in this period in the 1860s and the 1870s, the biggest spectacle in Australia at the time is the Melbourne Cup horse race in November. And by the 1870s, 100,000 people, the equivalent of close to a third or even half of the population of Melbourne, are turning up to this horse race. This is a single event. But what the football did really quickly was it was getting 10 and 20,000 people turning up every week, every Saturday, to watch these suburban teams play one another. Now, obviously, the supporters identify with the suburb they are living in at the time. But this is a mass migration society. There is no single tribe that's dominant. So the English-born are barely half the total population. The very big Irish contingent, very big Scottish contingent, very big Chinese contingent, very big American, very big French. It is the most diverse Australia has been since now. Mm. Now is the only period, only the second time in our history since those sort of marvellous decades of the 19th century when we were this diverse. So back then, if you've got to think about it, a number of languages spoken, a number of faiths been observed. You couldn't tell this group, let's coalesce around the idea of Protestant faith or Catholicism or this brand of democracy or this brand of market economy, wherever. A lot of these ideologies wouldn't have connected all these people. The sport is literally born in the same breath as the settlement gives itself entitlements, like the vote and the eight-hour day. It is woven into the social fabric of the city of Melbourne almost at its foundation. It is the one thing that unites everybody in a very, very peaceful way. And you recognise it today in sporting codes around the world. Most middle-class societies can collect a number of people in the one place, whether it's a Saturday or a Sunday or a Friday night. And for those 2 hours that you're barracking for your team, you forget your religious differences, your political differences, your class differences, your racial differences. So I think one of it's an accident of timing. The other part of it, which I think is the most magnificent story we'd ever tell about ourselves, is when we collected a whole lot of people together in one go, and this is a more confident and a more sort of uplifting version of our sporting obsession, which is we grabbed sport almost immediately as a common language.
Funnily enough, it tribalises us, but it brings us together at the same time.
But the tribal identity is ferociously held, but it permits you to see the humanity in the other tribe. My fanaticism and your fanaticism. So as Richmond and Swan supporters, we can have a
shared understanding of each other's absurdities. Perhaps
absolutely, but we can also be tetchy about it. Yeah, but there'll always be a smile on our face while we're having this conversation. You and I obviously don't have that many differences. But let's say we had a political or religious difference. You become, and I'll become very defensive in that discussion. In the footy discussion, the scoreboard will settle the score for us one way or another, and then we might whinge about bad calls and whatever. But at the end of the day, I'm just as interested in the first day you went to a game as you might be interested in the first day I went to a game. And I'm interested in your family story, and I'm interested in where you were in 2005 when the Swans break their 70-something-year duck. as you might be interested in where I was, or where a Cronulla fan might have been in rugby league, or where a...
Queensland Cowboys supporter would have been, yeah.
Absolutely,
that's right, yeah.
Absolutely.
And you see this happening across politics too, like people who are bitterly divided in the Chamber of Parliament find that they have these cross allegiances to one another.
Look, I don't want to tell any tales out of school, but one of the first unsolicited book reviews I got for this book last weekend was from a Liberal politician telling me, I'm going to take this to all my mates in Canberra and show them this book and remind them that there's a better way of running the country. Unfortunately, he's an Essendon supporter, so I'll have to take that with a grain of salt.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio.
Now, the 70s era in footy, that was, I remember that era, that's when I started following the game. That was when you had names starting to pop up, like Barassi. He's the 60s as well, but Barassi, Silvani, and Jezelenko. And the game seemed to be, this was Carlton pretty much though, wasn't it?
Yes.
What about your team, Richmond, the Greekest, well, one of the Greekest suburbs in Australia?
Well, between Richmond and Collingwood, the two Greekest suburbs, Richmond remained a pretty white bread club. The interesting thing about the clubs, through that post-war period, their supporter base is changing because some of their supporters are leaving the inner city for the outer suburbs, taking their loyalties with them, and the new arrivals in the suburb don't necessarily have a reason to hook into the club, but as people like my mother ended up doing, they connect to the club almost immediately because it's the biggest game in the suburb. It's the biggest show in the suburb. And so the ethnic face of the clubs is changing in the stands, but on field it's not necessarily changing. And Richmond's quite an interesting parable for that sort of 70s, late 60s, 70s, even into the early 80s. They remind me politically, so my adult eyes looking back on my childhood obsession, I see part Fraser, part Hawke. So I see media manipulator, quite charismatic, that's the Hawke side, and I see use any means to achieve power and to retain it, Fraser. And that's what that club was like. So it was much whiter on the field than its own, what was becoming its own new supporter base. It was they were the biggest bastards in the competition in those days. They set themselves up not just against every other club, and they're very successful at it, but also against the administration. They are the first sporting team in Australia to be seen by a million people, which is 1972. The 1980 season, which was the last of the old Richmond premierships, the average attendance at the MCG for a home game crossed over 50,000 for the first time for any sporting club in Australia. And you think, this is 1980. This is a long time ago. So a very popular club. They sort of presented themselves as anti-establishment, but they were the establishment. They were the top dogs. So in the NRN, the New South Wales Rugby League in those days, would have been the Canterbury Bankstown Bulldogs, would have been probably the equivalent club. Strong working class identity, but with a mass appeal across the city. And they were brilliant to watch, but they're also god-awful in the way they conducted themselves on the field. That 70s, you and I grew up in an era where...
It's very violent, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, the cameras are on everything, and for the first time, they're catching the biff. Now, the biff has probably always been there, but... And you can see it, especially in some of the suburban grounds. As soon as the fighting starts and up gets the mob in the stands, they're not throwing punches at each other. By the way, this is just an extended version of World Championship Wrestling on the field.
Players were being sent on with instructions by their coaches to thump another player.
Well, yeah. Every single week and every single team. So I know who the Richmond guys are. They don't want to admit to these things anymore, but. You know, there'd be committee men. There was a particular power broker at Richmond called Graham Richmond, coincidentally, who'd say so-and-so might use a bit of rougher than normal treatment here. You don't want to get so-and-so to get off the leash. Maybe you ought to whack so-and-so. And then he'd say this out of earshot of the coach, and the coach knew that this was going on. And out go one of the enforcers, belts another guy. And, of course, as a young supporter, I wonder how you used to see this, I would perceive every attack on our team as the most outrageous insult that was ever committed in all of human history. And when our guys did something back, this is through 7, 8, 9, 10-year-old eyes, you'd think, serves them right, because they've been picking on us.
Yeah. Doesn't that describe our politics these days? It certainly describes America's politics. When my side does it, it's fine. When their side does it, it's an outrage.
You forgive every sin on your side, because winning, it's all about winning, and you don't want to give the other team an advantage. So you can't acknowledge weakness.
In the end, that has a corrosive effect on the game, doesn't it, though, in the long run? It makes your supporters very one-eyed, but it keeps away other people from the game. And this is the kind of repulsion with politics, my side, right or wrong.
Yeah, so as I was sort of tracking this story and sort of reminding myself of my childhood, do you know, this is where the echo of the contemporary political scene starts. I didn't start out thinking I was going to write about contemporary politics. I thought I'd write about the suburb and the club and a bit of a love letter towards the end on the 2017 season. But it started to occur to me as I was reminding myself of the past that there's an inversion between sport and politics. So sport, especially in national competitions, clubs have been forced to think differently to be able to survive because it's a much more ruthless competition. You can't sort of get an advantage in a suburban league and then maintain it through fear, intimidation, checkbook. Competition is now equalised. I hate that phrase, but it's very socialist objective in rugby league and especially in Aussie rules, salary caps, drafts, and it's very, very difficult to stay up for too long. So you have to think differently about how you win in an 18-team or a 16-team competition. So in that world, you're sort of moving to a much more ordered, much more collaborative, sort of less hectoring kind of operation. So the coach and the star player are not the centre of gravity in the club. Power is distributed, communities are considered, supporter bases, needs are better catered for. In politics, of course, you go from great collaborative models with mass membership political parties, with governments that respect advice from bureaucracy, with oppositions that think that I need to earn the right to govern, so I have to give a positive message. I need an alternative program rather than something I can knock down. That's just sort of 70s, 80s, India 90s political story. Suddenly politics starts to look to me, and it has been apparent now for a number of years, it reminds me of the Richmond of old. And not just in the way the parties conduct themselves with power and when they were without it. Something about the temperament of political debate now is like that very old tribal sporting debate.
Tell me something then about Richmond and how it fell into this hole that eventually it found its way out of. What were the key aspects of Richmond's decline in the 80s, 90s to 2000s, as you said, George?
Yeah, so this is an extraordinary story. Richmond is probably the most public of these stories, but I think a number of the sort of big teams of the 60s and 70s in both the old VFL and the old New South Wales Rugby League really struggled once we moved into the 80s and once the sort of, you know, each game was tiptoeing to the other's territory to establish national competitions. And I think when these suburban clubs, which were sort of big in their closed competition, started to come up against state-based or city-based teams like an Adelaide or a West Coast Eagles or in the rugby leagues, a Canberra or a Brisbane.
Or Newcastle, in fact.
Yeah. Or a Newcastle. Mm. You've got a population base divided by 9 or 10 amongst the old suburban clubs. When the competition was contained to just that city, okay, the few clubs that survived would have been ones with sort of long histories of success. Those clubs didn't necessarily make the transition to national competition. So Richmond kept thinking it could do the thing that it always did. It had a bad year. It terminated the coach. It went in a poaching raid and got the best player from another team. After a bad year, one of the reasons why they thought they had to show blood on the floor to the members to make sure that the members bought another season's ticket or came back the next year, because we're just as upset as you are that we had a bad year, and look, we've just executed one of our own. Now, that sort of behaviour didn't work as well in a national competition, A, because you're up against a number of other teams that you hadn't encountered before with slightly different cultures. The other thing is they were drawing on an entire city for their energy, for their playing list, for their corporate dollar, for their supporter base. And it took a club like Richmond, and I know Carlton's had this problem, I know Hawthorn had this problem for a while, Carlton's sort of still in there, Collingwood had this problem. First response to deregulation in the sense of the code, Richmond borrowed and tried to buy the next best team when it started losing its own players. It threw its own players out because it didn't like them and then wanted to buy new ones. It borrowed, couldn't get a return in terms of premiership. And for demographic reasons and other reasons, you know, the sort of membership started to tail off and not as many people came to the game. And within 5 years, so this is quite interesting, they play in a grand final in 82. They lose that one by 3 goals to Carlton. People might remember that the streaker interrupts that game midway through the third quarter. And Richmond people for the next 30 years blame the streaker for loss of momentum in that game. 1987, they win a wooden spoon. In 1987, fewer people watched Richmond than at any time in its history at the MCG. In fact, the crowds in 87 were the equivalent crowds that they used to get in the worst years in the early 60s when they were at the Punt Road Oval. So within 5 years, the club has fallen off a cliff. It is actually not financially viable. By 1990, it's rattling the collection tin to try and pay off its debts. Collingwood is also in a hole at the time, but Collingwood got out a bit quicker and win a premiership in 1990. Richmond didn't just see what happened to themselves as the 80s as a warning that you need to shape up for a national competition. They thought, we'll just keep doing what we've always done. And so the 90s passed and the first decade of the 21st century passed, still trying to recreate some mythical period of the late 60s, early 70s.
So with every year that there's failure, there's the inclination to blame the players and the coach, the players and the coach. The coach gets sacked again and again and again. Players get shifted. Expensive players are brought in. What was wrong with that theory?
What was wrong with that theory? Do you know if, and just imagine yourself, you and I are not sports people, just imagine yourself you're going to work every day and you get a different boss every other year. Mm. You as a worker or as a player are going to have to reinvent yourself every couple of years. You don't learn anything. So these kids come in late teens, early 20s. A particular game plan goes to about 21, 22. New coach, new sets of favourites, clean out. That constant instability means that no club can build to sustain success. Now, it started to occur to the Victorian clubs that the more successful clubs were clubs that took many years to bring a group together, and that the players needed, you know, you needed a core of players that played about 100 games with each other before they were ready to succeed. It took Richmond so long to figure this out that you almost by definition had to think long term before you could get success. But because their trophy cabinet said, we used to be ruthless and we used to be winners by being ruthless, they thought, it worked in the past, why can't it work today? The game changed, the competition changes, they have to learn to think long term, and it took them a long time to figure this out. What they needed to learn, and this is quite a strange thing for a sporting club to realise, in a sense the on-field stuff is the last part of the process. The club had to learn to govern properly. So the instability in the back rooms, in the committee room, in the boardroom, that made the club a terrible place, A, to work for, and B, to play for.
So then we have two new figures that come into the club that change the club around. One is the new CEO, and then there's the other is the club president, who is effectively the chair of the club, who was a woman. Tell me about these two people and how they brought change to the club.
Yeah, so Brendan Gale's an interesting, very interesting character. He was a very successful player in one of these periods of underachievement through the 90s. So he played from early 90s through to 2001. Played in a couple of finals series, quite well regarded. Nickname was Tarzan, quite a sort of glamorous but not stylish player, if that makes sense. He could have been a grunge rocker. He always wore long hair, but he looked like an erudite player and he wore glasses off the field to save. And he was also a law student. When he finished up at football, he joined the Players Association. So he comes from a culture which is just Richmond. That's all he knows. And he didn't realise he was doing this. It took him a few years to figure this out. He was actually learning on the job to run a club by being the advocate for the players. A bit of Bob Hawke in him as an ACTU president. And he's seeing how successful clubs roll and how unsuccessful clubs roll. He's seen knee-jerk. He's seen clubs, especially when he would visit them on the Monday after a loss, the most instructive day of his work week at the Players Association, was to basically walk into a room after a heavy defeat and see how they handled it. And slowly but surely, he came to reinterpret his time of underachievement, on-field underachievement at Richmond, even though personally quite a successful player. And he saw that Richmond were doing things the wrong way. He would put Richmond, he won't say this, because he doesn't want to reflect on past administrations. In fact, he's a very difficult person to extract a quote out of, very non-political in this respect. He figured out that they need to think long term. Peggy O'Neill's the more interesting story, though, because it's the combination of the two that really clicks. She joins the board. Her first attempt to join the board was vetoed. She's a lawyer. And the partners, the majority of the partners were in Sydney at the time. And they said, why would you want to join a footy club? No one joins a rugby league club here. This is going to do brand damage to our law firm if we have one of our senior partners on the board of a club that's always going to get into trouble. I said, okay. They asked her again a couple of years later, and by this stage there's more WA and Victorian lawyers at board level. And they said, absolutely, this makes sense because footy is central to Victorian life. And wouldn't it be great to have one of our partners in this firm? She turns up and she sees that the club, and she'd been volunteering and doing other things before then, that the club literally didn't know how to govern. All the things that are standard, and her background's superannuation,
So she has to think long-term, in other words.
She has to think long-term. So it took them years to teach themselves this. And the most important thing that they learnt, that the premiership success that they promised the members had to come many years later after, firstly, they figured out how to govern, cleared their debts, and then slowly started to rebuild the culture. And in fact, they had to almost de-Richmondise themselves. The old Tigers had to be taken out and a new Tiger model had to be created. Now, they were doing this for 6 years together. Well, she was president a bit later, but Brendan Gale arrives in 2010. She's already on the board, and then she becomes president in 2014. At the end of the 2016 season, you might remember as a Sydney Swans supporter, the last game of that year, Richmond lose by 20 goals. The players walk off the field. All the commentators are baying for blood. The old Tiger DNA starts to reassert themselves, get rid of the coach, get rid of the captain, trade the best players, let's start again. Brendan and Peggy go, we're not going to do that. We're going to hang on to the coach. We're going to make some changes to the assistants. This is a long-term game here. We've had one bad year, but I think we're on the right track. They hung on to their coach, reinvested in the playing list, and the next year they win a premiership. I think it is literally impossible to manage that premiership in 2017 without that sort of cultural change, which took many, many years.
So they faced their Rudd Gillard, Rudd Abbott, Turnbull moments, and they stared it down.
They not only did they stare it down, in the process of staring it down, they gave confidence to the leadership that we're all on the same team. So even if let's say in 2010 Rudd was able to hang on to his job, he had half the caucus waiting for him to fall. Damon Hardwick, not only did they recommit to him, they said, we think you can be a great coach and we're going to help you become a better coach. So I keep imagining what Peggy O'Neill, Brendan Gale intervention should have occurred in 2010 with Kevin Rudd. There was no structure in the Labor Party in those days, no grand elders running the party to be able to sit Kevin down and say, mate, you're okay. We're going to win the next election, but these are the things we need to do. He would have just said, nah, forget it. Those people didn't exist to be able to do that anyway. And in the cabinet room, there weren't strong enough personalities to be able to stand him up before the crisis. Mm. Crisis comes, and in fact, Rudd and Gillard, they don't like admitting this. The very first argument, like proper argument they had, shouting match, was the day she said she was going to roll him. So they hadn't even cleared any of these past issues, and they kept a lid on it until they could no longer contain the emotion.
So the thing with the Richmond at this time is they stared this down and they reinvest in the coach. Now the coach, Damien, had been one of those, you know, shout at the team when they lose type coaches. This is a very common thing in the AFL, like, you gutless one, as you failed us, you failed your jumper, you should be ashamed.
You should be ashamed.
Shame, 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 shame. How did he change his approach with this team?
Well, one of the things that both Peggy O'Neill and Brendan Gale were able to do was in this sort of period of media storm, membership pressure to punt the coach. They said to him, one of your problems at the moment is you're getting too angry. The players want to play with you. They've obviously done a bit of research and the players still wanted to play for him. You need to calm down. Some of the things that you have in your home life and some of the things you have in your interactions with us, you're quite an empathetic person, you're not bringing to work with those young kids. And he, to his credit, they tell me that he had roughly the same epiphany. Now, there's an equivalent game against Melbourne in 2016 when he's yelling at him to respect the jumper. And then when they came back after another loss, he said, the jumper has issued its verdict. We're piss weak as a club. Great. So this inanimate object has told these kids, you're useless.
They're hopeless. Yeah.
Like, they didn't know it because they lost anyway.
Yeah.
2017, in preparation for the equivalent game against this team, and this team has had given Richmond trouble for a few years, he told a dad joke to introduce the team strategy. He tells a dad joke at the start of the rev up, where he describes a game of Connect Four with his daughter, and his daughter keeps beating him in Connect Four. She either draws the game or beats him because he gets too aggressive. And he was, and he used that as an analogy to then draw out the strategy. And the game actually played out the way he describes it, with this dumb dad joke at the start.
Now the other thing they brought in was a mindfulness coach for the players. Now, this would be the kind of thing that would have the older players or the old veterans just foaming at the mouth with rage. It's the kind of thing designed, it's arty-farty, you know, fairy, hippie stuff. Yet, it bears worth repeating, Richmond won the 2017 Grand Final. Paul Ruse, famously meditative approach, learnt a kind of zen-like approach to coaching footy. The Swans win their first flag in 72 years. This shouting and screaming doesn't seem to work as a leadership model anymore. What lessons are there here for our national politics, do you think, George?
Don't yell at voters. Stop yelling at voters. Stop playing to your base. Stop thinking that because your primary voter's got a three in front of it now, you could keep a three in front of it by just yelling on behalf of the third of the Australian electorate that still tribally identifies with you. Have conversations with people. Trust their intelligence. Talk the country up. The mindfulness one is a very interesting story. It was part of their, you know, sort of summer of self-reflection through 2016 into 2017. And then it got taken off the program. So players were allowed to then continue it on a needs basis. And so the ones that needed to keep knocking on the door weren't knocking on the door. They lost three games in a row by less than a goal. So they lost one to Fremantle, they lost one to Western Bulldogs, and they lost one, a terrible game, to the GWS Giants. And that old noise started around, you know, around nine of 2017 season, that Richmond are about to go crazy again. The head of the football department, Neil Baum, has a conversation with Emma Murray, the mindfulness coach, and said, "What's going wrong? We're losing these close games." And she said, "Well, it was in the program, then it got taken out of the program because there was too much clutter." And they said, "It's going back into the program." And from that week on, they have not lost two games in a row since that day. And what they've been doing with her is they've been assessing what happened to them on field. You know, when did you go out of flow? I mean, some of the language here is pretty
flow is when age. Flow is a kind of psychological term used in psychology. It's when you're in the moment, and when you're actually performing at the peak, where you're doing something really complex, but it's coming to you very easily and fluidly. It's this really lovely moment, and you're not focused on what someone's going to say down the track. You're just living quite in the moment, and this is something she was clearly able to achieve.
She was, but bear in mind now you've now got a woman in charge as president, and one of the coaches is teaching the mindfulness. So if you're looking for a couple of lessons, diversify.
Here's another lesson to be learned that the AFL had to be dragged into, kicking and screaming to some degree, which is to embracing Indigenous Australians, embracing Indigenous players. And this is these crucial moments in the 90s where you have Nicky Winmar lifting up his Guernsey and pointing at his black skin. Yeah. You have Michael Long taking on Collingwood players for racist sledging on the ground. And there's a real drag here. But nonetheless, the AFL does get across the line. What does this tell you when you compare the AFL's idea of inclusivity now compared to our federal politics and the way our parliament looks and the way our political leaders talk?
Yeah, I'm not so sure that I would give the AFL as a bureaucracy the credit. I would certainly give the community of football the credit. And we almost go back to the foundation story. It was the social glue in the 1850s and especially the 1860s and 1870s. It became the metropolitan and then the colonial faith. It became the Victorian faith, which meant it was almost inclusive from day one, which meant it cut across class and religious and even gender divides in the audience. So many more women go and watch Aussie Rules than watch pretty much any other, you know, winter team sport. So I think deep within the DNA was football was this idea that it had to solve this problem, it had to find a way to include Indigenous players. Now, the difficulty in this story, if you think about the foundation story, there is Mangrook in it, but there's still a bit of denial, I think, amongst Victorians about the Mangrook connection, because by the time footy's taken off in the 1860s and 1870s, local Indigenous populations wiped out. So strangely, even though it's an inclusive game with a traditional heritage, there's been very little contact in the stands in Victoria and even on the field up until the 70s and the early 80s with Indigenous players. I think what happened by the 90s, where there are enough Indigenous players in the competition to literally force a settlement on their behalf, almost for equal treatment on the field. Whether they're going to get equal treatment everywhere else is another story. But I think the game simply because of its foundation as an all classes, everyone welcome game, was probably the first one to be able to pull this off.
I think you make the distinction in your book about the difference between politics and a football team at the moment is that in politics you can build a narrow governing majority by setting one group of Australians against another. But you can't do that in footy anymore. It just won't work for you anymore. You can, the club will just be, it'll just become run down and degenerate.
It's too small. And the other thing is if it's us against them, the them is many more than you are.
Yeah. That's a real thought there. So Richmond's success really is brought down, as you say, to it's the elements that are missing in politics today. A united team, power exercised without ego, a dash of charisma and a committed support base. It's not that hard, would you put it like that, George? Maybe it's much harder than it seems.
Maybe it's much harder than it seems in contemporary political context, but what I'm hoping is the footy fans and the non-footy fans in Canberra, because I think they're sick of me telling them that they're running the country badly. I'm doing this almost by metaphor. It's a very cheeky way to get them back onto the story.
It's a harmless book about football. What's going to stop you from reading that? What a pleasure, George, to have you back on the program again.
Thank you very much.
George Megalogenis' book is called The Football Solution. I'm going to check over saying this again, but How Richmond's Premiership Can Save Australia. What a cheeky man he is writing a book with a title like that. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.